Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see everyone this evening, both online and in person. So my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. And on these evenings, we do about a 40-minute meditation. Then depending on the evening, we do either a shorter talk or a longer talk. This is a shorter talk night, and then we have a chance, space for doing a small group discussion around the topic of exploration. So we're exploring the paramis. This month is on truthfulness. So I'll just offer a few words of guidance to get us started. And truthfulness sometimes seems like a big word. We can also notice the simple truth of this moment's experience. Well, this moment, if we pay attention, is always unfolding in the form of sense data, like the breath, sounds, sensations, even thoughts. So connecting with this truth of this moment, acknowledging how this moment is showing up, expressing itself, and at the same time holding it lightly, allowing it to dissipate, to fade. And the next moment arises. So from a meditative perspective, it doesn't really matter what's arising in this moment. It's about acknowledging it, opening to it, meeting it. A poem called The Sacrament by Paul Ann Peterson. Become that high priest, the bee. Drone your way from one fragrant temple to another, nosing into each altar. Drink what's divine, and while you're there, let some of the sacred cling to your limbs. Wherever you go, leave a small trail of its golden crumbs. In your wake, the world unfolds. Its rapture, the fruit of its blooming. Rooms in your house fill with that sweetness your body both makes and eats. A Sacrament by Paul Ann Peterson. All right, so I'm going to launch right into this shorter talk, about 20 minutes. Then we'll have a chance to do a little stretch break and bathroom break, and then come back for small group discussions as we explore this topic together. So this month we're exploring truthfulness, one of the paramis, the 10 paramis. And truthfulness is such a kind of potent word, you know, like, is this truthful, or can I have this ideal? That's also such an essential part of our practice, of our meditation practice. In fact, of spirituality itself is, we can almost define the Dharma as learning to connect with what is actually true, what's actually true in this moment. Of course, there's the relative truth of this emotion, the sensation coming in my body. There's also more of the absolute truth, kind of the nature, the deeper nature of that the Dharma starts to unfold for us as our practice matures and deepens. So we can talk about truthfulness kind of in two categories. One is the falsehood, not speaking what's a lie, what's untrue. The other second is the connection with what actually is true. How do we access that? How do we recognize it? And how do we express it? So we'll explore both of those on this little recap talk from last week. So speaking of the falsehood, you know, not speaking that which is false. So you recognize this from the precepts, from the five precepts that we take at the beginning of the year, we take as we go on retreats. And it's these five kind of ethical trainings that help us kind of calm the system, calm the mind down, so we can actually perceive what's actually here. Because if we're always saying something untrue, there's a lot of internal noise that comes from that. There's a cute sutta that from the Buddha when he's talking to his young son who became a monk or a novice monk. And apparently Rahula, his son, had done some, spoken some kind of fib, some kind of lie. And the Buddha was using this analogy of, okay, they were sitting there washing their feet, and he said, see, Rahula, this bowl of water, when you tell a lie and I turn it upside down, that's all your good merit, all your fruits of your practice kind of just drain away because of doing that. This is how empty this bowl is. That's how empty your spiritual attainment is when you're willing to tell a lie. And he goes on even further to say that someone who's willing to tell a deliberate lie, there's really nothing they're not capable of doing. Any of the precepts, it's much easier to break when you don't have a relationship with reality. You don't have a relationship with what is true. So this is it's a very helpful precept to take on. Okay, well, how can I not tell something which is false? Of course, there's the whole other aspect of truthfulness, which we'll get to in a moment. Often when I teach residential retreats and I give their precepts, I like to include with this one not only aspects of noble silence, but also aspects of internal dialogue, your internal narrative. Because we can be really pretty diligent about not speaking something that's untrue, not lying out loud. But is that also true for our internal narrative? You know, how often do we say things to ourselves like, I'm always going to be like this? You know, these global statements, which, you know, really aren't true. You know, that yeah, maybe sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we fail at things, but doesn't define who and what we are. Of course, that healthy, or that maybe not unhealthy, but the robust inner critic, how often is that telling us something that's actually true? So start to extend that to your own internal narrative. And as you do that, you might find that there's a quieting that starts to happen. I remember when I started really exploring this kind of inner critic a lot in meditation, I would notice that initially it would be like this whole series of sentences. I would make some kind of blunder, some kind of mistake, and the critic would jump in and say, oh, you're such an idiot. You're always going to be doing that. You're never going to be any good at this. This is how you've been in the rest of your whole life and the rest of your life. Just paragraphs and paragraphs. And as I started to practice, I start to notice that I would see that pattern and able to release it without adding to it. So it might be, oh, you're such an idiot. And then I would just release that, come back into what's actually true in this moment. So eventually it was like, oh, you're such a, and then it would drop then. I'm such, and then it would drop then. So you could start to see the very beginning of that. It's really an intention of self-ill will, self-dislike, self-hatred. And that's a way that the words form around that. So working with this internally, of course, helps us externally. So speaking that which is not true, to refrain from that. Now, the other aspect of this is learning to recognize what is actually true. This, you know, this political season, you know, we have a lot of debate about what's actually true. There's a lot of back and forth. Now, my side is true, you're wrong, vice versa. And it's, for me, it really wears me out to hear how much divisiveness there is. As meditators, we start to have a different relationship to what is actually true. Think back before you started to meditate, your relationship to your thinking mind. Perhaps if you're like me, you had a relationship of really believing your thoughts, believing, okay, whatever I think, there must be some validity to it. You know, my mind must be saying something that's actually accurate. But once you start to meditate and actually learn to connect with something like the body and the breath, have a little distance from your thinking mind, you start to observe the mind, how often does your mind actually say something that even makes sense? You know, it's kind of all over the place. You start to realize that this mind has a lot of just momentum behind it, and that we actually start to not believe in it in the same way. We start to not believe everything that we think. This is a very different relationship to what's true, because usually we define truth by something that we think about or maybe how we feel very strongly about. But we can start to look at how there's actually different levels of truth. There's the relative truth of this moment. There's the truth of our opinions. One of the things we start to discover in this path, and one of the liberating aspects, is we start to see the difference between what is true versus our opinions and our beliefs. We start to see that I can have a strong opinion, a strong belief about something, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's universally true. It may not be true for anyone else in this room. From the suttas, there's this classic analogy of if you had an elephant here in this room and each one of us had lost our sight and just had access to one part of that elephant and we became very opinionated about that one part we were touching. So, okay, this is what an elephant is like. I'm defining this creature by this narrow, I'm feeling its tail. This is what the elephant is like. And then someone else would argue and say, no, you have no idea what you're talking about. The elephant is actually like a long, smooth spear because they got the tusk. Another one has the leg and is saying, oh, it's more like a tree trunk. And we have so much closeness of heart because we think our reality is true and we discount everyone else's. There's so much harm that comes from that, not being able to listen and open to another person's point of view. A practice that I've shared a number of times that my wife and I learned from my teacher before we became married was really a relational practice of deep listening. Because so often we listen kind of more as a waiting game. I'm going to listen in order to be able to have my chance to say what I want to say. And the exercise was just every day spend as much time as you needed listening to each other. But as you listen, the other person has to actually paraphrase what was said to the point the other person says, yeah, you have it. You understood what I just said. And our relationship, you know, being fairly new, only a few, maybe 5 years or so together, but there's still this accumulation of our unconscious patterns. As we started to do this, it was amazing just to hear the different layers that was going on. And without trying to argue or trying to justify it, but just to really listen, to really step out of my own point of view and her stepping out of her point of view, to really deeply listen, we got to glimpse the truth of that person, the truth of their experience. And we still do this when we have, you know, times when we get in an argument or a little conflict, because it helps us move from that polarity, that sense of separation, to actually listen. And it actually is a beautiful experience of uncovering the shared truth, the truth of your experience. Because the truth is so relative. You know, the way that we view the world, like for example, mowing the grass, right? So when my family that I grew up in, my dad always mowed the grass. And when I got old enough, then I mowed the grass. But in her family, her mom mowed the grass. So she thought she should do it. So we have this argument of how we think, who's supposed to mow the grass? What's the gender role assigned to it? And as we start to listen back beyond our opinions to actual the reality of it, their actual experience, we got to really appreciate that. And then you can actually have that meeting. So this is an example of us learning to connect with what's true. Because so often what's true is covered up by our conditioning, our delusion, our ignorance. And meditation practice, the Dharma practice, is learning to see through that, actually clear our eyes. Like that, one of my favorite Dharma poems is that everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. This is by Samuel Green. That walking the yard with coffee cooling in my hand, I stop at a single seed of hawksbeard, balanced on a blade of grass. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? This first line, that everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. We could define that simple phrase as a experiencing of truth. What is actually true in this moment? When we're able to release things, other people, ourselves, from the burden of what we know, our opinions, our beliefs, we actually see them for who they actually are. That freedom, that releasing them, then they allow it to be themselves again. When you perceive things how they actually are, that's an expression of truth, to connection with truth. When we're in the middle of really being gripped by something, we're really hooked by some experience, an interaction, a situation. Our beliefs seem so true, don't they? They seem so strong. Byron Katie, a spiritual teacher in this day and age, developed this beautiful way of working with this, to actually ask these four liberating questions. First question, is it true? Is this thing I'm believing, is it actually true? The second question, can we absolutely know that it's true? So this is going beyond our kind of superficial conviction in our beliefs, in our thoughts, in our ideas. How do you react when you believe that thought? You know, what's the owning your own experience with this? This is going to a deeper level of what's true. And the fourth question is, who would you be without that thought? Who would you be without that thought? What am I believing is true? Now, truthfulness, we often see it in the Eightfold Path. It's one of the path factors, speaking truthfully, not speaking a falsehood. There's actually three kind of gates that's helpful that the Buddha talked about. Gateways for our words. We can include our written expression. We include texting, emails, anything like that, to kind of go through these three gateways before we express it. The first gateway, is it actually true? Okay, so is this an actual true statement? And so is this my belief? Is it my opinion? Is it a relative truth? Is it my own experience, the truth of that, but not necessarily the universal truth? Then there's whether it is actually beneficial. Is it actually beneficial for this person to receive this from us? Sometimes you talk about speaking what's true, and then you see couples in the parking lot having these heated arguments as they tell each other their opinions or their truth about the other person. Like, let me tell you your truth, my truth about you, well, my opinions about you. Now, is it beneficial for this person? And the Buddha held beneficiality as being, does it lead to liberation? So that's a pretty high bar. And then finally, what's the timing? Is the timing right? Is there a sense of receptivity? Is the person open and able to hear when you like to share with them? Now, truth, trying to actually perceive it and allow it to arise, sometimes it is covered up by so many different layers of conditioning and programming, cultural, family, all these different things we have to see through. There's a phrase from the Insight Dialogue tradition. This is Gregory Kramer's work, where he developed a kind of interpersonal way of exploring Dharma concepts, asking questions, other person responds, real time. It's like meditating out loud, basically. And one of the questions, or one of the guidance, is to trust emergence, to trust things to arise out. And this is such a, going back to last month's parami of patience, is to be able to be in contact, in relationship to this present moment, whether it's with another person, just your own experience, and letting things quiet down and trusting something to arise. This is what, was it the Christians say, the small, quiet voice? You know, there's a quiet voice that arises, and that you can start to recognize that as perhaps being more true. Now, truth is tricky because we have this, our opinions kind of get in our way. We confuse these so often. And you start to practice the Dharma and study Buddhism, you get a whole lot of other things you can think is true. Right? What are the Four Noble Truths? You know, what's the Four Foundations of Mindfulness? All these kind of big concepts. They're three characteristics. I think the Buddha's intention, and certainly our intention as teachers, is for you to see this truth for yourself, to take it from this intellectual understanding to this direct knowing, this direct seeing in this mind-body. It's almost like a laboratory or a classroom, that if you learn to listen and see and sense clearly, it starts to reveal itself to you. That's one of the gifts of meditation. It allows you to see things in a more direct, immediate way. So then these lists of the Buddha, these teachings of the Buddha start to become alive for you. That's one of the benefits of kind of holding us to this inquiry around one of the paramis each month, is that hopefully you kind of work with it in your own experience, because it does take time for your own realization to arise. You actually have to test it out. You know, is it as valid when you're sitting in meditation as when you're in an argument with someone, or you're trying to do your work or trying to navigate traffic? How does these paramis, how does all the Dharma start to show forth? And this is this willingness to release what we think is true to actually keep holding the question. It's like that analogy of the elephant and the unsighted people trying to sense it. And if you just held it, your experience, okay, this is my experience. Tell me your experience. Let me see if I can feel that part of the elephant for myself. Holding our own experience more and more lightly. And the truth, one teacher described it, is always going to be paradoxical. It's going to seem like a paradox to the rational mind. The rational mind is going to look at it and say, that doesn't make sense. We see this in the tradition of Zen. The Zen, Renzai Zen, when they do the koans, the Zen riddles, like, show me your face before you were born. Manifest the sound of one hand clapping. Okay, from a rational mind, you're like, you know, I have no idea how to do that. But what's asking the students to do in that case is to actually shift from their normal way of perceiving, to actually shift from a more awakened perspective, shifting from the duality to allow it to shift, to be manifest. So everything we see carries the burden of what we know, until we let it be itself again. So don't use the Dharma practice as something to add more burden, more constriction. Allow it to open to that mystery of things arising, moment by moment. Because the good news is it only takes a moment to see. And it's that in that clear seeing, in that moment of clear seeing, that is what transforms you. I mean, think back to when you first started a practice and maybe the first time you had an insight. And you saw life in a different way. You saw yourself in a different way. In that moment of clear seeing, of that contact to that truth of that moment, you open to a deeper truth of who you were. That's the transformational process and practice. So it all starts with this learning to see and connect with how this moment is. What is this breath? What is this mind? Not what we want it to be, but how it actually is. So developing this really deep appreciation for what the truth of this moment and the paradox of holding it lightly allows the next moment to arise. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, letting those words settle. And in this silence, this shared silence, just this simple acknowledgement of what this moment actually is. How much effort does that take? All right, so I thought tonight it might be a nice topic to explore through a dyad. Right, so dyad is two people. So usually we've been doing small groups, like three, you know, 4 to 5 people. But dyad is a powerful way of exploring some Dharma concept or some, really it's almost like an out loud meditation. Because usually when we meditate by ourselves, our minds get distracted, it's harder to keep our focus. When you have someone else kind of sitting right in front of you, they help remind you, okay, let me look a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper. And so the way we do the dyads, or one way we'll do it tonight, is that there'll be two people, and both online and also in person. And that's a cute dog, Austin. So we'll have two people, and you know, don't feel like it has to be some kind of like, you know, it's the social pressure, because you can close your eyes if you like. And one person's going to be asking a question. It's going to be one simple question, and you're going to just repeat it very gently. It's not going to be like a rapid fire interrogation. It's going to be more like an invitation. And another person is going to take as much time as they want to allow something to emerge, right? And it's probably helpful to make it just like a, maybe a sentence or two. It doesn't have to be this whole paragraph, just like, okay, this is what I'm seeing in this moment. Because the power of it is then you come back into silence, the person asks a question again, and then you see what else arises. So the question asked again and again in a very gentle way allows you to keep looking a little bit more deeply. Does that make sense? And then we'll do that for 5 minutes, then we'll switch roles, and then we'll go back to the first person, do a second question. All right, does that make sense? Any questions about the dyad process? Yes, let me.
So it's just groups of two?
Groups of two. No, you're going to share a turn. So you're going to be two persons. Let's say person A, person B.
Okay.
Person A is going to ask the question. Person B is going to respond. Then we'll switch in 5 minutes.
Okay, I
yeah, and then we'll do it again. Second cycle, second round. Yes.
What type of question?
Ah, I'm going to give you the question. Yeah, I'm going to give you the question. That would be hard. Yeah, the first question is going to be, what do you believe is true in this moment? What do you believe is true in this moment? So as you hear that question, it's almost like letting a rock drop through the depths of a pond. Okay, what do I believe is true? Okay, I believe I'm sitting here. Okay, what do I believe is true? And then you just let something deeper come up. It's nice, you can actually be really surprised by what arises if you don't have any expectations. Right, and the second question is going to kind of turn that a little bit on its head. Okay, any questions online about all that? Okay, so the first question, the first person who's going to be asking the question, person A, is going to ask the simple question. What do you believe is true in this moment? What are you believing is true in this moment? You ask the question, give some space for the person to respond, pause for a couple seconds, then ask the question again. I ring the bell in 5 minutes, you switch roles. All right, then I ring the bell again and we'll go back. All right, so go ahead and begin. Okay, just staying where you are, coming back into silence. Just noticing what's arising in this body and mind, what this felt sense of this experience was like. And we're going to do one more cycle. So going back to the first person asking, second other person responding. This question is similar, but slightly different. What do you know is true in this moment? What do you know is true in this moment? All right, so begin. All right, pausing back into silence. Noticing what's present. And now reversing again, so the person who was just asking the question now is responding, and vice versa. What do you know is true in this moment? What do you know is true in this moment? Okay, coming back into silence for a moment. Just acknowledging the felt sense of this experience, a shared dialogue. And then for about a minute or two, just talking with your partners freely. What was this experience like? What did you notice? And then we'll come back to the larger group. All right, so what was that experience like? What do you want to talk about or explore around truthfulness or falsehood? Who would like to speak? You can raise your hand. We'll bring the mic over so they can hear you online. If you're online, you can just raise your virtual hand and we'll call on you. Adam, right there.
Hi. I thought about that. What you said at the very end of your talk of how much effort does it take to be aware of the truth, how much effort does it take? And it's funny how in the dyad I could feel myself like efforting to think of the truth. And I think when I'm by myself in meditation, there's a bit more ease there because it's just me. But when there's someone else present, there's feels like there's this extra layer of sharing what's true for me. So, yeah, that was interesting.
That's right, yeah. I didn't say that it's effortless to articulate the truth or to express yourself. And, yeah, so the interpersonal, there's all kinds of the dynamics. Like you're watching and someone makes a little micro gesture of their face and then you cause all these reactions. It just kind of bounces all over. But it's true in that moment of just that acknowledgement, and there's not much effort that's needed. And that can be a nice way of practicing too, is just, because so often we're struggling with how we want that moment to be versus how it actually is. Sometimes just acknowledging, okay, this is how this moment is. I'm upset, I'm happy, I'm angry. Just that acknowledgement loosens something in us. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Do you have a question or a sharing?
I just thought it was interesting that the what we think of as true when you put the question to us in some ways becomes almost a riddle. And I was wondering how people would have answered this question through the eras, because now, and maybe not differently, but now I say to myself, well, do I know that the air is passing over me? I guess I believe I feel that there's air passing over me. And it becomes more of a belief in the sense that I'm feeling the sensations. And that is almost, to me, getting to the idea of like, it feels like the practice is trying to ground us in our bodies in many ways. And these questions sort of, wouldn't say did the opposite, but it got intellectual in a way, which seemed a little different than what I would have, a different direction than I would have expected.
Yeah, it could be that the questions could have been more skillfully, you know, framed from my perspective. Because part of what I was trying to hopefully point out is that we're going to believe a lot of things is true in this moment. But when we actually look what is actually true in this moment. So it's kind of often we do a contrasting question. You know, one shows kind of the struggle. One shows liberation in a broad sense. So what am I believing is true versus what do I know is true in this moment? Because of the knowing, at least for myself when I would do this, it's not really what I think is true. It's not through my mind is what I have access to. But it's like, okay, what's my sense data in this moment? Like in this moment, what do I know is true? Is sound? There's a silence. There's a tingling awareness pulling pulled into a tingling into this left hand. You know, there's that kind of a, it could go that way. So it's just kind of playing with, see how what comes from that.
No, I think that's interesting. So the belief versus the knowing. Okay, yeah. I don't think I saw it the first time.
Hey, Leslie, go ahead.
I found myself struggling with finding the words, that the words were not necessarily encompassing what I was, you know, feeling or, you know, and I, part of it is this intellectual exercise. I know that that box is a box in one part of my brain, but it has this angle and that angle and, you know, sort of trying, I don't know, I'm kind of off the, but it's like trying to find the words that don't express what I sense. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of my intentions, was to show the limitations of thought and words. Because we can look at something and say that's a box or that's a certain shade of black, and we can get really accurate with it. But the reality, it's always being interpreted through our history, our memory. And I would say that there's a conditional reality to it or conditional truth to that. But if we actually, if I'm really connecting with the truth of this, words start to fall away. They don't really make sense. And so that was kind of one of my hopes, is that would start to bring that forth.
That worked for me.
Good. Good. Anyone else? Yeah, so on the other side, and then we'll come back. Actually, Adam, why don't you grab that gentleman, and then we'll go back just to make it a little, so Adam doesn't get too worn out running around.
Something that I thought was interesting that happened to me when we got to the second question, what we know is true, is I started including statements as opposed to like my physical reality in the room. And arguably, like, the statements I made are somewhat subjective. Like, one of the things that I said is the United States Postal Service mails too much junk mail. That's something that I know is true, but arguably is subjective. So I'm still trying to unpack that, honestly, and, like, why I would even think that's something I know versus something I believe.
Yeah, so it's highlighting that whole territory, because it can be a really strong belief, but is it an absolute truth? Do we know it's absolutely true? Does everyone share this truth? Is another way of looking at it. Now, if I could have thought of a way to do this, what is true if you don't use any words? Of course, then how do you do a dialogue? But, you know, how do you, what's the truth outside of thought? Maybe that would have been a good one to say. Should we do another one? No. All right, so, and then we can see if there's anyone online too. Okay, Carla, we'll get to you in a second.
Hi, Tim. I'm Han.
Yeah.
First of all, great exercise. Really enjoyed it. This is not really a big insight or anything, but I'd like to believe that I'm not the only one who had this experience where I got really hung up on the word what you believe is true in the first exercise, and then when you asked the second question, I just kind of laughed because, you know, you switched it to what you know is true.
Yeah.
And actually, what was funny is that I broke the rules unintentionally because I didn't know what the second question was, but I started talking to my partner, Ben, and I said, well, this is something that I know is true during the belief section, and that made me laugh even more when you switched the question up. So just thought I'd share that.
Good. Yeah, thank you for sharing that on. Yeah, there's, you know, there's so much interpretation around it. But, you know, generally, I try to do the dyads, like one kind of shows that contraction or limited view, acknowledging that. Other side is kind of showing maybe beyond words or kind of the liberating view. But that's, you know, however we did it, it's all a learning process. Okay, Carla online.
Yeah, I just started Tweri's course on emptiness, this online course. So, like, in a nutshell, as someone who's never experienced emptiness, I'm going to say it's a course that leads us slowly towards maybe glimpsing more ultimate reality than relative reality. So it was so funny when you like told us what the questions were. I just immediately wanted to say, well, do you mean what's ultimately true or what's relatively true? Because I'm now thinking constantly and I can't not think about that. Like nothing is actually true right now. But what was interesting, I mean, I guess I did sort of give myself time and I was quiet for a long time and I did sink in deeper, and what I landed on right now that I've only just begun exploring this was the relative reality of the body. I mean, I think I just read a sutta where the Buddha was saying, you know, we can't really experience ultimate reality out there, but the body in the body is points at that's the place of practice. And I was like, well, definitely, I think the relative reality of my sense perceptions, I believe, is true on this relative plane. But then I think the most interesting moment for me was my cat was next to me and was being very purry and like incredibly sweet. And I had these, you know, strong feelings of like affection and care and how much I love this being. And then I was sort of wondering, is that like, what about like the sense of care and love? Is that true or not? And I wasn't sure, but I think it was the one thing that really was the most interesting for me. There was something there where I had a sense of, you know, because we talk about wisdom and compassion being two sides of like the same coin, like love and care being possibly ultimate reality. I was like, yeah, because it's interpersonal, it's not just within my body, it is something, an energy that goes out to other life forms in this shared existence. I was like, I guess I just realized that's a really fascinating thing to explore. How true is that or not?
That's right. It's like there's a kind of the relative and absolute truths, I think, are so just, nice kind of handle to explore, because there's the relative truth. Okay, there's an affection, relative truth, I should say, of that affection for the cat and what it's eliciting. And at the same time, that's something that's kind of transitory. It's kind of passing and moving through. We start to look at more of the absolute truths. It's interesting how the absolute starts to inform the relative, you know, and starts to transform it. But the absolute truth is, it's kind of what's the basic assumption of ourselves and others, and how are we perceiving from that? What flows from that perception? Separation, separate self, outside self, you know, two different people, you know, there's that separation that's set up. Sometimes it can be very connected, but sometimes there is also, there's the base level that there's two different things here. Absolute reality, what happens is that centralized sense of self falls away. We actually see, we kind of fall back into the kind of the baseline or the backdrop of everything. We actually touch into kind of the matrix that everything is connected to. Don't think about the movie right now, but yeah, there's some interesting things with that movie. But anyway, so there's that basic non-separation. From that perception, there's a whole different understanding of what is true in this moment. And it's hard to point to with words. So it's kind of, we flow back and forth between those. And there's that relative. And that's, in some ways, what is actually true is harder to really define. We really look more and more closely. What is really true in this moment? But we can know what's not true, right? Okay, I'm denying this moment. I'm lying about my actions, my behavior, my inner experience. That's a negation of the truth. So that's kind of the fundamental. And there's this opening to what is actually true. So thank you, Carla. Okay, Frankie, you want to go ahead?
Hi. This was a cool exercise. I had a fun partner. But between the two questions, one thing I noticed is that like someone else mentioned the concept of efforting, like in the belief question, I really felt myself efforting to come up with something and I felt pressure to not ruin this experience for my partner. But then by the time we got to the second question and we settled in, I noticed the same kind of just arising of the body sensations, awareness of just what is actually here and now in this moment. And it made me think about like, so we tune out so much data input all the time just to function and do our mental, whatever we have to do day to day. And it's interesting that our sense of truth often is based upon a whole like inference we form with a whole bunch of stuff tuned out, like just information we're just ignoring just to have whatever our truth is. And it was kind of fascinating. I felt a sense of gratitude for getting to notice that in the second question for sure. So that's all I had to say.
Well, beautiful. That's a great way of describing it. Because often when I'm trying to access what's true, it is a sense of kind of opening beyond my normal narrow mind and, you know, whatever I might be in my head is, okay, what's actually here? What sounds are present? What sensations are present? What emotions, you know, what thoughts are coming up? And I think that kind of broadening, kind of letting the other data come in helps us get a more complete sense of the truth. I think that's part of like with like Carla's question around interrelationship. It's like there's a shared truth that's coming on. You know, it's like how can we start to see and perceive the other person really accurately and express ourselves? And a lot of that is kind of stepping out of our own kind of blinders that we put on. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Frankie. All right, Austin, would you like to go ahead and then we'll see if there's anyone back here in the room?
Just very quickly, Tim, I was going to say that mysterious is what came up for me, that the truth is sometimes mysterious. And I love the definition I had just seen on Google around mysterious, you know, difficult to really understand or quite put your finger on. And there's something that's powerful about that in a spiritual way. And I was meditating the other day and felt in my back on my right side this sensation that signaled just safety and connectedness. Mm. And my mind just went back to memories of laying on my grandmother's couch before she died and feeling that sense of connectedness and safety and knowing the moment was transient. And like, oh my goodness, you know, there's something mysterious about that. The truth of that experience, both in the meditation and that memory, and I can't quite explain it, but I know that it's true.
Yeah, I think that mystery and truth, I mean, that could be a whole exploration too, how we sometimes think as truth, but we often think of it kind of in a way that kind of cages it or, you know, solidifies it versus the aliveness of this moment manifesting. And whether it's connecting to our past sense of safety, like being with your grandmother, or, you know, just the mystery of stillness or the absolute. Thank you, Austin. All right, anyone else here? Yeah, Beth, go ahead.
Well, just real quick, I don't know if anybody else would be interested, but I would love to watch The Matrix with you. I would love to have a Dhamma teacher called Tim Guile watch The Matrix and give a Dhamma talk on The Matrix, because apparently I'm too old to understand The Matrix. My children understand it, but my binary mind takes over and I'm like, I don't understand this. So maybe you can help me.
Well, I mean, we were renting a new hall down the way that we're going to, one of the ideas Tori and I have is to have Dharma movies. Yeah. We could have refreshments. We could have like blue and red jelly beans. We could all wear sunglasses, kind of Morpheus up kind of thing. Black leather. Okay. But yeah, that would be great. Yeah, we could have watch a movie, have a discussion about it. That'd be lovely. Yeah. All right, we'll put it on our list. All right. Anyone else before we end? All right, go ahead, Adam.
I wanted to share one thing that came up for me, specifically with the second question, was that about halfway through, I found myself really not wanting to answer. The internal reaction to the question kind of was almost, I think, maybe like what a koan would be like, mm-hmm. or it was like, wow, there was so much richness in the experience of like opening to like what was true in that moment that I was just kind of like, can I just not answer this one? And ultimately I did. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, we moved on, but I really liked that there was that, you know, a few moments where it was like, oh wow, there's so much that is true that I can't really put words to, but there is that richness there.
Yes. Yeah. That was, you know, one of the things that could arise from that. I've done dyads with a, you know, very senior Sims practitioner, and she actually wouldn't say much or would not say anything. I just float the question and just, you know, she's kind of in that middle of that stillness. It's like, okay, there's no words come forth. So that's how I often like to do it. I just give myself lots of space and just see what words arise. Sometimes, you know, there's something that arises. Sometimes it's just the stillness. Yeah, there's no right or wrong way to do it. All right, so thank you all for this engagement. It's, you can feel these kind of discussion nights help us kind of really articulate our own understanding of the practice in a different way, hear another person's experience of it, and it grows the power of Sangha, how we're all together on this journey. And we support each other in that. So I'll be back next week and offering a new talk on the truthfulness. Sorry, just double checking. There's no chat. And I hope to see you there next week or here next week. All right, be well and practice your relationship with truthfulness.